When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Everybody, welcome to the first Elise Glink podcast. This one, although it sounds the same as my WSB podcast, is going to be a little bit different. I'm no longer associated with WSB, and I am associated with a whole bunch of other things. So I promised you that we would be talking about really cool stuff, and we are. It's going to be about real estate and about money, and also a little bit about branding and social media. Things that you need to do to improve your business, all those tools that we used to talk about on the show every year on this show. So I'm so excited to be doing this with you. We are going to have amazing guests. We are going to do all sorts of fun things. The conversations are going to be terrific. Now, one thing I should tell you is that this audio, not the one that I'm talking right now, but the audio that you're going to be hearing comes from a new show that I do, a new video show called Big Money Real Estate, and it airs on my YouTube channel, Expert Real Estate Tips, which if you're not subscribed to, you really ought to be soon. But Big Money Real Estate also airs on something called Wit Nation. Wit Nation is the brainchild of a really good guy named Grant Cardone. And Grant's been a guest on my show many, many times, and he invited me to participate in this very new venture, which is exciting. There are a whole lot of interesting voices on that channel, but I talk there about real estate, what's going on with the real estate industry, and I answer your questions, I give you my two cents, Glinkonomics, and all the rest. So you may want to check out those videos. They're really, really cool. In addition, I'm doing a lot of Real Estate Minutes now, which you can see on my YouTube channel. And you may want to check that out. As I said, you can subscribe. And if you're not signed up for my free weekly newsletter, you should do that. Right now, you're doing that at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. But in the next couple of weeks, we're launching eliseglink.com, ilyceglink.com. But I think if you just type in iGlink, you're going to get to the same place, or just Elise, ilyce.com. We'll also get you to the right place. That's a very exciting new move for me as well, and you'll get a whole different kind of a sense of who I am as a personality and what are the different things that I do and can teach you. All right, so our first episode of the Elise Glink Show podcast, we're going to be talking about really interesting things. So we have Jessica Lotz from the National Association of Realtors. She is the director of survey research and communications at the National Association of Realtors. They just came out with their annual investment and vacation homebuyer survey for 2015. We're going to be hearing about that. We're also going to be talking about some new models for credit. And I've talked about this a little bit. You know, the housing market has just gotten so incredibly unaffordable in places. And Ken Fears is the director of housing finance and regional economics of the National Association of Realtors. And he recently went to a symposium, or he helped host a symposium in Washington discussing new ways of calculating credit worthiness that opens up the mortgage market to buyers who have proven themselves to be financially responsible in ways that just are not factored in by FICO. And you've heard me talk about this with eCredible and Steve Ely, who is the former president of the Personal Solutions Division of Equifax, and he went on to help found eCredible. And he works on sort of affordable housing issues and for people who don't qualify, don't have a FICO score. There's like 50 million people out there without a FICO score. So that's going to be really interesting. We have Darren Bloomquist on the show, and you're going to hear my conversation with him. He's vice president of real estate information for RealtyTrack. And he's discussing, and we discuss, wage growth, what's going on with wage growth, with home price appreciation. I have to remember how to talk again. We're going to talk about that and what's going on in different places around the U.S. because, to my mind, there is just this crazy thing going on here where home price appreciation has outpaced wage growth by 13 to 1. So wages are up 1.3%. Home prices are up 17%. And if you know anything about charts, that is unsustainable. So we're going to talk about that as well and hopefully come up with some stuff. And then we've got Dan Goldstein, who's the personal finance and real estate reporter for MarketWatch. And he's talking about the mortgagee clause, which is very overlooked for many homeowners insurance policies and can cause huge headaches for you when it comes time to collect on a major claim. So that's what we're doing today. I'll probably also answer a question that came in. Right now, I don't have a way for us to have this conversation live, although I sure wish I did. So since I can't have it live, I would love for you to email me. And you can email me at questions@thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. That address is not going to change. You can also follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. You can become a fan of the Elise Glink fan page. We post all kinds of cool stuff there. And of course, sign up for the free weekly newsletter. Somebody, if you just hit reply on the newsletter, somebody, probably me, will see that email. And I would be happy to have that conversation with you any other way. I'm still writing my nationally syndicated column. It's still in like 80 newspapers and websites around the country. And so there's lots of Think Glink everywhere that you can imagine. But I'm particularly excited to be able to do this podcast with you and to bring you these amazing voices. And I hope you will share this podcast far and wide with everybody you know and post it and talk about it and all the rest so we can help more people with this housing market and their money, because that is what's so near and dear to my heart. So we're going to kick things off now with Jessica Louts. Let me know how you like this. Please send us some feedback. Again, it's questions@thinklink.com. And thank you for joining me. Jessica Louts is from the National Association of Realtors, and she's Director of Survey Research and Communications at NAR. They just came out with the annual Investment and Vacation Home Buyers Survey for 2015. That's going to be really important for anybody out there thinking about buying a vacation home, second home, or investment property. Jessica, welcome back.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about your survey. Who did you survey, and what were the high-level findings?
So we survey recent homebuyers who purchased a home in the last year. So they're purchasing in the calendar year of 2014. We found this year a huge rise in vacation homebuyers for the overall share of the market. So we actually found that they rose to 21%, and that's up from 13% in 2013.
Wow. That's actually a really huge number, 21%. What is the typical number of vacation homebuyers out there? I remember it being something like 6%.
Yeah, and it has risen the last 2 years, actually. So this year it was a 57% jump, which is very large. And that follows a 29% jump last year.
What do you guys attribute that to?
We attribute it to a few factors. So there's definitely vacation buyers out there who are picking up the last of the distressed properties, and they're able to put all cash down for lower priced homes. We're also attributing this to baby boomers and a generational shift where they're thinking about, you know what, I really want to vacation more this year, but in the future, that's the place that I want to retire. I really want to be on the beach. I want to be in the mountains. I want to be in a lakefront, and not necessarily in the city center where I'm living right now.
Interesting. So the median price you found was $150,000 for these vacation homes. That was down 11% from 2013. But what's interesting is the median income of buyers is higher, $94,000. And also $150,000 is in it falling, that the vacation home price is falling, whereas all other kinds of prices are going up and have been going up. How do you explain that?
So what we did find is that among our primary residence buyers, so those who are going to be living in their home full time, that the price absolutely did rise. Now, among our vacation buyers and our investors, both of the prices dropped this year. And I think it is because they're picking up this large portion of distressed properties right now. 45% of our vacation buyers and 46% of our investors are actually purchasing distressed homes. So they're purchasing a slightly different home in the market than our primary residence buyers out there.
Interesting. So they're buying distressed property. Why aren't other investors picking up these properties at these prices? Are the prices too high for the investors to guarantee the return?
I think that they have been rising, so there's fewer of these homes out there, but we also see that there is this dynamic shift. So with this rise in vacation buyers, perhaps they're picking up the nicer homes that are out there and not the investor type homes. We also see that the size of the home shifted this year and the type of home changed. So we're seeing this rise in condos and townhouses, where in the past we saw that investors and vacation buyers were actually picking up all different types of homes on the market. But we do see this rise in condos this year as well.
Interesting. Now, investment home purchases, according to your survey, are down roughly 7.5% from 2013. What was the total number of investment home purchases? And I assume by home you mean single family or condo or townhouse.
Right. Yes, they could be any type of property. So we saw that the overall share was 19% of the market this year, and that is a drop. And that follows a several-year drop that we've had in investors overall in the market. So we are seeing this incremental decrease after this huge boom during the recession and housing crash of all of these investors coming in. Now, one caveat that I will say about this is that these are not institutional bulk investors in the market. These are mom-and-pop investors. These are perhaps someone who's walking around their community and says, you know what, that's a good buy. I want to purchase that.
Well, anybody who's looking sort of locally, I mean, real estate has always been like this, local market. There are always going to be opportunities available to you simply because you don't have, like, you know, these huge hedge fund investors pouring millions of dollars in and buying 10, 15,000 homes in a swap anymore. And even for other kinds of investors, I think that the market has risen in price. Doesn't mean that you as an individual investor can't make money. Now, the median incomes that you're finding of buyers is over $87,000, but that's lower than last year. What's the median income telling you?
The median income, so for vacation buyers, those who are out there, the median income did rise this year to 94,000. But we do see that it was about the same as we had last year for investors in the market. Now, again, we're talking about a different type of investor who could be buying a lower priced home as well. So their income could reflect their actual purchase price of that home.
Okay. And so who is buying? What are the characteristics of the investment buyer that you're seeing this year?
So we're still seeing that our investors are picking up distressed properties. One of the other things that we're seeing on both our vacation buyers and our investors is that about 30%, one third of them, are actually putting down all cash for that home. So they're not actually taking on a mortgage. So they are getting a good deal in the market. When we look at our investors, their intention for buying is slightly different than our vacation buyers, of course, but they're still buying because it's a good deal and they do see potential price appreciation.
Interesting. Now, your study found that 68% intend to buy another investment property in the next 2 years. Is that because of the two-year rollover rule where as long as you keep a home for 2 years and then you sell it, you'll be able to, you know, keep the profits tax-free, or this is an accumulation strategy and it just takes them another 2 years to get together enough cash? What are you finding?
Well, I think that that's an intention. So the intentions is not always reality. So while they may think that it's a good idea to actually buy another vacation home or another investment home, and we do see this among our primary residence buyers too, that they're thinking, you know, this was a good opportunity. This was a good time to buy. What do I think that I would do in 2 years? Sure, in a dream world, I would love to as well. But I don't know that that intention and that sentiment going in is actually the reality.
Now, are you finding that the best places to find distressed properties or investment properties is still in the South and then the West? Are we still seeing that kind of Georgia, Mississippi, Florida, that, you know, that kind of a Southeast category still in trouble from the Great Recession and the housing crisis? And then you've got out West, and by West, actually, I'm wondering if you mean Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, South California. Are those the two categories that we're really going to see investors continue to focus on in the next year?
Well, what we are seeing right now, and this report, unfortunately, is only broken down into the broad census regions, the four census regions. So what we do see right now is that there was a bulk of purchases in the southern region. So especially among our vacation buyers, more than 40% were actually buying in the south. So we are seeing that if there's the lower priced home on the market, if that's perhaps like a good environment on the beach, If that's potential price appreciation as well, that would be an ideal community for them to purchase in. But unfortunately, we didn't break this down on a state or local basis.
All right. So then my last question for you is, with, you know, all I hear from realtors are there aren't enough homes in the market. People want to buy. There aren't enough homes for sale. And they're trying to encourage sellers to move out. But you've got still a whole bunch of sellers that are landlocked around negative equity. And you've got a bunch of sellers that just aren't selling. So Are we going to run out of investment properties that are ripe for the picking for investors anytime soon?
Well, I think that's part of the reason why we did see this drop, and we're seeing the continual several-year drop of investors in the market, is that there's fewer properties for sale. And so there is competition out there for these properties, but there's just not that opportunity that there had been in past years. I do think that this is a problem for primary residence buyers, especially first-time buyers who want to come in the market. There is a lot of competition out there, especially for those lower-priced homes. So we do see the investors are snagging them up, where the primary residence buyers perhaps don't have that opportunity.
Yeah, and first-time buyers, nowhere to be found. Jessica Louts is the Director of Survey Research and Communications at the National Association of Realtors. Hey, thanks for coming back, Jessica. Cool stuff.
Thank you. Thanks.
So guess what? Tax time. Your personal income taxes are due on April 15th, and that's just a few days away. Here are some of the bigger changes from the IRS that will likely affect part of your return. If your income exceeds $406,750 if you're single and $457,600 if you're married, those are pretty high levels, your marginal tax rate will hit 39.6% this year. And that's up slightly from last year. The standard deduction rises to $6,200 for singles and married persons filing separate returns. It's $12,400 double for married couples filing jointly. That's up slightly from tax year 2013. Standard deduction for heads of households rises to $9,100 up from $8,950. Now, the limitation for itemized deductions claimed in tax year 2014 returns of individuals begins with incomes of $254,200 or more. It's a little bit over $305,000 for married couples filing jointly. This is where the whole issue of the deductibility for mortgage interest and property taxes gets a little bit fuzzy, because only about 25% of taxpayers can actually claim these deductions. And yet, if you start to phase out on the upper end or you don't qualify on the lower end, you know, there's a whole huge fight out there to preserve this for not so many people. Now, the personal exemption number rises to $3,950 for this year, for the 2014 year, up from $3,900 of last year. It's just a slight change. But the exemption is subject to a phase out that begins with adjusted gross incomes of $254,200, and that's the $305,000 number for married couples filing jointly, phases out completely at $376,700, for singles or filing separately, and $427,550 for married couples filing jointly. The alternative minimum tax exemption, let me say that again, alternative minimum tax exemption, wow, for tax year 2014 is $52,800. It's $82,100 for married couples filing jointly, and that's up a little bit from 2013. And the maximum earned income tax credit amount, $6,143 for taxpayers who file jointly who have three or more qualifying children, and that's up slightly from 2013 as well. The revenue procedure has a table providing maximum credit amounts for other categories, income thresholds, and phase outs, and you can find that online at irs.gov. Now, here's a bigger change that I think is going to impact a lot of people who regularly watch this program. The estates of people who die during 2014, or I should say who died last year, have a basic exclusion amount of $5,340,000. And that is up almost $100,000 from 2013. So the old amount last year for taxes 2013, $5,250,000. This year goes up to $5,340,000. And remember that this number is actually indexed to inflation, and so next year it's going to go up again. That means that any one person can pass down $5.34 million tax-free when they die. That's $10,680,000 for two people. And if you do some smart tax planning, you can probably do a bunch more than that. So if you have a big estate, if you've been buying investment real estate for a long period of time, and it looks like the current value of that is already above $5.3 million or the $10.6 million, you probably ought to get yourself to an estate attorney or estate planner, PDQ, pretty darn quickly. Now, the annual exclusion for gifts remains at $14,000 for 2014 and 2015. That means you can give anyone a gift of up to $14,000 and not have it cause a taxable event. So if, for example, you have three children and they are each married and they each have two children, that is 12 people that you can give a gift of $14,000 each to, allowing you to get $168,000 out of your estate. You can also just pay for things like college tuition or school tuition for a grandchild without limitation, as long as you write the check directly to the school. Now, the annual dollar limit on employee contributions to employer-sponsored healthcare flexible spending arrangements, those are FSAs, remains unchanged at $2,500. The foreign earned income exclusion rises to $99,200 for the tax year 2015. That's up a couple of grand from 2013. The small employer health insurance credit provides that the maximum credit is phased out based on the employer's number of full-time equivalent employees in excess of 10 and the employer's average annual wages in excess of $25,400 for the tax year 2014, and that's up from $25,000 in 2013. Finally, and this is really important, there have been so many tax scams already that have been flying around the internet, phishing scams, other kinds of robocalling scams. The IRS has asked people like me to tell you that they really don't want you falling victim to a tax scam this tax season. So, bottom line, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true, right? You can find a list of the top 12 tax scams at IRS.gov. If you know of a tax fraud, you can report it to the IRS by sending completed form 3949A, information referral to IRS, Fresno, California, 93888. And remember this, if nothing else, and that's why it's at the end of this, the IRS will never send you an email asking for information. So if you get an email that purports to be from the IRS requesting personal or financial information or has a link that looks like it goes to IRS.gov, don't click it. This is a scam. I can tell you 100%, this is a scam. Do not respond to this email. Do not respond to any text messages or requests from social media channel, again, purporting to be from the IRS. Do not respond to the email. Instead, if the IRS needs to contact you, they're going to send you a letter at the address the IRS has on file for you, so please keep it updated. Let me repeat again, emails from the IRS are not from the IRS. And if you need to go to the IRS.gov website, please open up a new tab on your browser, open up a new browser and go to IRS.gov. You type it in yourself and then you know you'll be safe. This week, RealtyTrack, which is a real estate information company, has released its latest report comparing wage growth to home price appreciation across the United States. If you're a longtime follower of this show or my radio show, you know that I believe that real estate and job growth are tied together directly. If you don't have a job that's going to pay your mortgage, you're not buying a house, at least not any kind of house that needs a mortgage. RealtyTrack analyzed the growth in average weekly wages from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, and overlaid that on the median home price sales from sales data that it had in 184 metro areas nationwide. And they were comparing 2014 to 2012. What they found is that home price appreciation outpaces wage growth in 76% of U.S. markets during the recovery over the last 2 years. That home price appreciation has outstripped wage growth 13 to 1. Wages are up over the last 2 years, 1.3%. Home prices are up 17%. That is crazy numbers. Now, in the 184 metro areas analyzed, the average wages were up 3.7%. Home prices were up 13.4%. In 140 markets where the trend held up, the strongest of it was in Detroit, which is really interesting, right? Low, one of the worst places for the housing recession, housing crisis, and now coming back. San Francisco, which has just been on fire. Atlanta, also lowest to highest. Houston, which held pretty steady all the way through, Miami, Los Angeles, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, and Washington, D.C. Now, there were 44 exceptions where wages actually outpaced home price appreciation. Some of those included Tulsa, Oklahoma City, Raleigh, Honolulu, that's kind of surprising, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Virginia Beach, New Jersey, New York, New Jersey area. So it looks like going forward, wage growth is going to become a much more important driver of home appreciation, because if we don't start to see some real growth now, what we've done is take all the low-hanging fruit off the table. Houses are more expensive. You're going to have to earn more in order to be able to buy more. Darren Blomquist is vice president of the realty information firm RealtyTrack. He's back again with me today, this time to discuss RealtyTrack's latest report comparing wage growth to home price appreciation across the United States. Wage growth has been about 1.3%. Home price appreciation has been 17%. If you track that out, you can see that we're quickly going to have a problem in this country. Darren, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
So what are you guys thinking? Because this report came out and you found that nationwide home price appreciation outpaced wage growth by 13-1, where wages are up 1.3% over the last couple of years, but home prices have shot up 17%. That's just unsustainable, right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, to be fair, this is over a period where the housing market has rebounded very strongly. But we're coming up on a point in many markets where that we've reached that tipping point where if this continues, home prices are going to become very unaffordable for people making the average wage or the median income in those markets. So it's been okay in a lot of markets. We're actually still okay. They're still affordable because, in a sense, home prices had to catch up after overcorrecting on the downside during the housing downturn. But we really are at that point where if this continues, it's going to be trouble for many markets.
Well, we have another issue, which is, of course, that the Federal Reserve Bank, which has held interest rates super low, they have been buying up billions and billions and billions of dollars every month for years of mortgage-backed securities, artificially keeping interest rates really low. They have announced that they are going to be lifting the lid at some point in time this year on that and shutting it down so that you would expect interest rates to bounce up at least a little. It looks like, even just from my sort of armchair analysis of this, that even if home prices don't continue to appreciate at 8.5% per year, you're going to quickly run into an affordability gap, even if mortgage interest rates just pop up even 1 or 2%. What are your economists telling you?
Yeah, that's a great point. And basically, what they're saying is there's no room for growth in interest rates. I mean, the Fed has somewhat backed itself into a corner. These low interest rates have helped stimulate the housing market, but now if those interest rates rise, you'll see that affordability become a problem very quickly. One of the reasons that most markets are still affordable is because of those rock bottom interest rates. And so really the only lever or the only thing that can change in this equation, I mean, you have home prices, you have interest rates, and you have wages. And the only thing that can change now to make the situation better is wages, I think. The other alternatives are interest rates go up, makes things unaffordable. Home prices keep going up, makes things unaffordable. And so the only other thing is that wages go up. And so that's what I think a lot of economists are holding their breath and hoping that finally some of the recovery trickles down and affects wages more than it has over the past couple of years.
So I have to just kind of, we've been talking on the show, and I think the world is talking about this, the fact that alternative credit is now becoming a little bit more mainstream. And there was, over the last couple of weeks, the first week of April, there was a symposium, I think it was held in D.C., and Castro, the HUD, Department of Human Housing and Urban Development secretary, he was talking about how HUD and FHA are now realizing that they have to really push the acceptance of alternative credit data for the 50 million people who don't even have FICO scores. The problem is a lot of these people who don't have FICO scores really don't earn enough to they don't earn any more than the average amount. And if housing prices go up and mortgage interest rates go up, it doesn't matter that you add 50 million more people to the home buying front. There are not going to be any houses for them to buy. The home prices will continue to soar simply because more people will be chasing fewer houses. I'm not sure how all of this is a win. So any insights there?
You know, I think all of what you say, I totally agree with. And I think that what this tells us is that we can't completely, policy alone, government policy alone is not going to completely paper over the fact that we just went through a huge housing crisis that has lingering effects. And by fixing one problem, which is stimulating house prices, you've caused some other problems, which become affordability. And of course, if home prices slow down, which I think that's the most likely scenario, is home price appreciation is really going to flatten out this year. That's good. That may be good and solve the problem of affordability to a certain extent, but then you have all those underwater homeowners who are counting on that home price appreciation to keep going up, who are going to be underwater now for a few more years as home prices stagnate. So I think to me, the takeaway is there's no policy that's a silver bullet that's going to solve all the problems that were caused by this housing bubble and housing crisis that we've been through over the past 7 to 8 years.
You actually bring up a really great point, which is that the people who are underwater, who they've been, you know, one of the reasons that the government has been pushing to raise home prices is, of course, to get more people out from being underwater and allow them more freedom and flexibility to sell and move on with their lives, take new jobs, get rid of their homes. But there's a whole core group of people who are still severely underwater, people who bought in 04, 05, 06, and 07, who for them, and it's millions of people that we're talking about, That you're right. That door to get them to at least parity is going to be shut on them pretty soon. And if home prices don't keep appreciating, but on the other side, if they don't keep appreciating, you know, we're not going to see, you know, we're going to see interest rates go up, and that's going to again swing the balance of unaffordability. I'm really glad you guys have done this report. I think it's very helpful to shine a light on just how complicated it is when you've got government policy that's trying to balance needs on sort of every side of the coin, really hard to make it a win-win-win for everybody. And of course, we're going to keep watching this for you as well. Darren Blomquist is Vice President at Realty Track. Hey, thanks again for joining us today, Darren. We're going to have you again on soon. Dan Goldstein's the real estate reporter for Market Watch, and he's on the show today to talk about an often overlooked clause in many homeowners insurance policies that can cause huge headaches when it comes time to collect on a major claim. Welcome to the show, Dan. So tell me what you've learned about the mortgagee clause.
Well, thanks for, first of all, having me. And the mortgagee clause, or it's called the loss payee clause, is a really interesting facet that you have to look carefully in your insurance policy for, because it really can trip you up. Because if you have an insurance claim and it's a big enough insurance claim, you might not get the full check from your insurance company. It may actually be co-signed with your bank, and that's just going to cause a whole bunch of hassles because you literally have to go to the bank to get your own money.
Right. So what ends up happening is, let's just say your house catches on fire and burns down. It's insured for $300,000. Typically, if you have a mortgage, that check is made out to the bank and to you. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. And the thing is you will probably get a check free and clear for the initial cleanup. So let's say you have a $300,000 home and it causes maybe $50,000 in damage. You might get $10,000 or $7,500 free and clear just with your name on that check, so that you can do the necessary initial repairs, like get the water out of your house, maybe put a temporary patch on your roof or something that you need to do so you can make the house livable. But when it comes to actually doing the repairs to bring it up to its original condition, that's where this loss payee and mortgage payee clause comes in. Now, not surprisingly, your bank does, if you have a mortgage, your bank does have an interest, a financial interest, in making sure the repair gets done and repair gets done right. I don't think anybody disputes that. You don't want to go off to take the insurance money and go to Las Vegas with it.
Sure.
But the problem, what we've seen just doing some investigation, is there really is no rhyme or reason as to when these checks actually get escrowed, as it were, by the bank. Some companies will give you the money, your insurance companies will give you money free and clear, but generally what we found is that if you hit a $25,000 or $20,000 mark, that's when it starts getting escrowed. But the problem is, just talking to a lot of trade groups and a lot of banks and a lot of homeowners, they were completely surprised that this was going to happen.
So if people are, I don't know why people are that surprised. I mean, banks are really trying to protect their financial interest in the house. Clearly, as you point out, you know, they don't want you running away to Mexico with it or Canada. But, you know, one of the points that you said came up is that banks want to make sure that homeowners aren't overcharged for repairs. How is it that the banks even have any insight in whether the homeowners are being overcharged for repairs? Wouldn't it be, you know, more incumbent upon the insurance company to worry about that rather than the bank? Like, why does the bank care whether I pay an extra $5,000 to have my bath redone?
Well, again, it comes down to the insurance company is really only doing this to protect themselves, because if the insurance company writes you a check free and clear for, say, the entire amount, $80,000, and let's say you spend $20,000 on the repair and take $60,000 to, you know, pay off your home equity line of credit and take a vacation, well, the repair hasn't been done, and so the bank is on the hook if, say, that you foreclose and they've got to actually come back and make the repairs. And what the insurance companies have been telling me is that if they don't do that, then the banks have every right to come back to the insurance company and say, hey, this wasn't done right, you need to pay us again.
Interesting. Now, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae created guidelines on insurance payouts for loans that are current or less than 31 days delinquent. Why did they do that?
Well, and this was part of what was happening. And I've been trying to figure out exactly where this comes from. And some people have said, you know, this happened because of Hurricane Katrina, where people, unfortunately, some of them took the insurance money and only later decided not to rebuild. And So that caused a huge issue. And it simply wasn't able to have the communication because people moved out of state. They decided not to rebuild in Louisiana. So that became an issue. But this has been an issue even before that, especially because we have the secondary market. If you buy a loan from somebody, they want to know that, you know, the asset isn't impaired if there's a if there's an insurance claim. So it has some, you know, some genesis beyond just what happened during Hurricane Katrina. But, you know, the reality is that even with these guidelines, and they are just guidelines, a lot of homeowners have said, look, we've ran into a whole bunch of trouble because instead of, say, you know, as you've seen with the guidelines, where you get a third up front, a third in the middle, and a third at the end, you know, I talked to one homeowner who got 10 $8,700 checks from a bank, and they didn't break it up into a third. They broke it up into 10 separate pieces, and it was a hassle every single time they had to make make repairs beyond that initial $8,700.
What are the questions that homeowners should ask, I guess, when they're either buying their insurance policies or if something happens and they're filing claims? Like, are there a series of questions that homeowners should ask?
Well, and unfortunately, it's more of just simply be aware that this can happen. And if this does happen, you know, this is why you want savings, so that you have the cash on hand to make yourself whole, do these repairs while you fight through the insurance company and the banks going back and forth.
But there
are a couple things you can do. One of them is to know what your bank's policy is. What are they going to make you do? Are they going to escrow your check? Are they going to require you to submit them an estimate or competing bids? And the second thing is to ask the insurance company when they start putting your co-signers on the check, because you might be able to get a check free and clear for $10,000, but if the claim is over that, you need to know from your insurance company when they start writing the bank's name on that check, or they simply send the check to the bank to be escrowed.
Sounds good. Dan, thank you so much. That's really interesting. Do you have the story up online?
It is. You can find it at marketwatch.com under our real estate section.
All right. That sounds great. Dan Goldstein is the real estate reporter for MarketWatch. Dan, this was great. Well, we'd like to have you back on the show. You come back again?
Absolutely. Love to.
For any hopeful home buyer who feels constrained, shall we say, by a credit score that's a little too low for today's lending standards, there may be some good news coming. The National Association of Realtors, along with the Asian Real Estate Association of America and the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals, and I promise you they all have acronyms that make a whole lot more sense than that, hosted a symposium recently in Washington to discuss new ways of calculating credit worthiness that might open up the mortgage market to buyers who have proven themselves to be financially responsible in ways that haven't been factored into the older models. So in other words, we might finally be getting somewhere with alternative credit. And we saw a big announcement about this the last couple of days from Equifax and FICO, which announced a new alternative credit scoring model that we're going to talk about as well. Here to talk about what happened at the symposium, which included a number of big names in the housing community, including HUD Secretary Julian Castro, is Ken Fears. He's Director of Housing Finance and Regional Economics at the National Association of Realtors. Hey, Ken, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's start with the big news first. Let's talk about what happened at this symposium. I guess it was a huge week for credit because you had the symposium the first week of April, and then we also at the end of that week got this news that Equifax and FICO were going to team up to model alternative data based on, I think it's utility payments, but let's start with what happened at the symposium.
Okay, well, we had a nice turnout, and most importantly, we had the FHA director announce that they would indeed begin to look at alternative credit scoring models. Very good for the FHA because it'll help them reduce costs, but at the same time, helps them with their mission of extending credit to groups that aren't currently receiving it.
Right, which is actually very nice. So one of the things that's been announced was FICO 9. And FICO 9 was announced to say that medical debts were going to have less impact on credit scores. The effect of missed payments on debts that were subsequently paid off is eliminated. It's incorporating utility and rental payments, and that helps young and minority applicants who may have a thinner history of credit use. They're called thin file. And FICO estimates that its new model could actually improve scores by 25 to 100 basis points, which is great, except that nobody's even using FICO 8, which came before FICO 9. And in fact, everybody's back using, like, I think FICO original from 20 years ago. What did that come up at the conference?
Yes, that was a very heated topic, or a topic of elevated interest. As you point out, the current model that's being used by the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the FHA date from the 1990s. And obviously, there's been a tremendous amount of information since then, data collected over 20 years. And
Google. There's Google since then.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's go there. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I would point out also is that VantageScore, which is put together by Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, has entered the market. But they, too, aren't accepted by FHA or Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae. And they're the ones who are driving a lot of these changes. So competition, just in terms of the number of credit score reporting agency, will help tremendously.
Okay. So what do you think it's going to take to pressure the government, which says they really want to have alternative forms of credit? And by the way, all the big lenders are legally required to consider alternate data. The problem is, in fact, they can't because they all use desktop underwriter and other kinds of electronic underwriting systems, and those don't. They're not supposed to bounce you for that, but they effectively do. So government's saying, yeah, we want this alternative data, but we don't actually have any way to assess it. How do you think this could come into play?
Well, I think one thing that's going to become quite clear in the years ahead is that improving the credit scoring models is going to reduce the cost to the government or to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or whoever utilizes them. So streamlining and incorporating a lot of these innovations, again, will reduce those costs. So any headwinds that they have in terms of cost or structure that they need to recalibrate will be more than offset by all these higher revenues or, again, reduced costs. So I think that's one thing that will certainly help. But again, secondly, if they're able to allow into the market another 30 to 35 million more people who didn't have credit scores beforehand, you're talking about much more social and economic engagement, much more important, and will grow in importance over the next two decades.
Interesting. What did Equifax and FICO announce the end of last week that is different from what you were talking about at your meeting?
Well, what was different from their prior model, which was FICO 9, they announced in the fall, Under FICO 9, they were going to relax how much they incorporated or how important old medical debt was or old debt. And by seasoning that out or allowing that to move off the score a bit, it helps to boost the score. What was different this time is they were going to partner together to incorporate utility payments as well as telecommunication payments. And there are a large swath of people, nearly 50 million people who aren't scored currently. By incorporating these people, the FICO estimates that they will increase the number of scorable persons by 25 million, so a significant increase, by 15 to 25 million, significant increase. And about 5 million of these people have a credit score over 620. Again, that means that they can enter in the mortgage market and purchase a home. They're either near prime or prime, so it's very important in terms of economic engagement.
Why haven't Experian and TransUnion done a similar deal with FICO?
All the three of them together worked to put together VantageScore, and VantageScore is a competitor of FICO. And so VantageScore has actually been doing this for several years now. The problem, again, is that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the FHA don't accept the VantageScore for accept or reject decisions or pricing. So when that gets changed, what you'll see is an immediate impact from these other credit companies.
So the real question is, when is all that going to happen? I know that Equifax and FICO are now making this announcement, but how long does it take for that to get rolling? And I should point out, just in the interest of full disclosure, I am the managing editor of the Equifax Finance blog, though I didn't actually know about this until it was announced in the Wall Street Journal. How long do you think it'll take for this to start to have an impact on these 15 to 25 to 50 million people who don't have a FICO score?
Well, I think it really depends on the agencies as well as the GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's a matter of whether they're willing to accept it and how long it'll take to retool these models. But these models have been in existence for a while, in particular the VantageScore models, FICO 9 and the new as yet unnamed FICO score, which was announced last week. These are a little bit newer, but again, these are very large houses with lots of research, and they should be able to turn it around fairly quickly. It's just a matter of how quickly the agencies will absorb them and okay them, because really that's the pull that they need to push them across the finish line.
And did the HUD director give you any insight into how they might propel that forward or require this alternative score to be accepted?
Unfortunately, they didn't this time. They just announced that they'd be looking at it.
Okay. Ken Fierce is Director of Housing Finance and Regional Economics at the National Association of Realtors. Hey, thank you so much for your insights, Ken.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for the inaugural edition of the Elise Glink radio show podcast, though we're not in the radio anymore. I'm so glad you joined me. I'll be back next week. We're hoping to do this every single week and then maybe throw in a few additional podcasts just for kicks. Different topics, different kinds of conversations. But in the meantime, until we figure out how to get you live on the air with me, I want to encourage you to send your questions, whether written, video, or audio, to questions@thinklink.com. You can also put up something at Facebook on the Elise Glink fan page. You can email me through Twitter. I'm @Glink, or just comment on our Twitter feed. And be sure to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. It comes out Mondays and Thursdays, and it'll keep you abreast of every single thing going on in Glink World, as we like to call it. So in the meantime, take advantage of those super low interest rates. I saw that the 30-year fixed rate mortgage this week is hovering around 3.5%. You got to jump at that, folks. That is a can't-miss deal. And in the meantime, I'll be back next week. Have a great week, everybody.